good enough. So let me start. I'm going to pose some related questions, and these are in the abstract too. And part of the point is that there are things that, you know, we can make connections. So the first one is, let's say we're doing, say, some medical research, and you know, in the medical study, typically you've got a whole bunch of different variables. So there's lots and lots of patients, and each patient has all kinds of things. They have an age, and they have a history, and they have their blood pressure, and they have their medical conditions, and they have their family relations, and all these things. And then maybe you want to give some treatment for some disease, and you want to say, well, okay, how are they doing after the treatment compared to before the treatment? But it depends on all these other things. So you want to have some big conclusion, yes, this drug makes you better, or no, this drug makes you worse, or oops, this drug will kill you, or something like that. But you know, you want to make a conclusion in the face of lots and lots of variables. So that comes up all the time in statistical sciences. We have lots and lots of variables, and we want to try to sort out the connections between them. Here's something kind of different. If you're interested in physics, then in physical systems, and in what's usually called statistical physics, there's usually lots of different particles, and there might be rules for how they interact. There might be rules for what energies are associated with what configurations and so on. And then you'd like to ask questions like, on average, how far apart will the particles be? Or what's the probability they'll be really close? Or what configurations are the most likely and so on? So again, you've got, in this case, lots and lots of particles leading to lots and lots of variables with complicated interactions between them. Third question is more from mathematics, or from numerical mathematics, let's say, that we might have a high-dimensional and complicated integral that we need to evaluate. And of course, we need to evaluate integrals for all kinds of different reasons. And then we might say, well, how can we evaluate it? Now, of course, we know from calculus and so on that often we can find an analytic solution. But usually we can't if things are complicated. So you've got a big complicated integral. Maybe you can't integrate it analytically. How can you approximately integrate it? Well, you can use numerical techniques, but as the dimension gets high, that gets harder and harder. So that's a challenge, too. Here's a more mundane question. So why do casinos make money, right? And so here's something that probably we all kind of know, but to me, these are all connected, or at least MCMC is a way to consider the first three questions, and it's related to ways that we think about understanding the fourth, about casinos and about averages in the long run and so on. So let me start with casinos, and again, this will be something that we pretty much all know, but I want us to think about it a little bit because it'll have some connections to the MCMC algorithms. So let's imagine repeated gambling, and in particular, let's take a specific game. Let's take the game craps. So it's a great example for problems, not only because of the strange name of the game, right, but because, you know, as probably you all know, it's this game where you repeatedly roll these two dice, and, you know, there's some sort of funny rules, right? If you get a 7 or 11 the first time, then you win. If you get a 2 or a 3 or a 12, then you lose. If you get some other number, like let's say a 4, then that number becomes your point, and then you keep on rolling over and over again until you either get another 7, then you lose, or until you match that 4, that point, and then you win. So it's kind of funny rules, and you say, well, why would there be such funny rules for a little game with dice? And the answer really is the probabilities, right? So the probability of winning, if you play craps, you can work out all the possibilities and conditional probabilities, works out to 49.29% chance, right? So probably since you're all in the mathematical sciences, you've all realized that's just a little bit less than the 50-50, right? So, and the point being that, of course, like all casino games, it's weighted just a little bit in favor of the house. And let me say, well, what happens? So if you bet once, you have a 49.29% chance of winning. What happens if you bet more? And I'm going to run the first of several sort of graphical simulations here to try to get us thinking about this in ways that I'll find helpful. So let's see how we do here. So this is here supposed to be a model for someone who's going to keep on betting at craps. And this is how much money they have. So it starts at 100, if you can see that. So they start with $100. Each time they're going to bet $10 at craps. So they're either going to win $10 or lose $10. Let me get that going if that works. So it's saying, okay, on the next bet, you're either going to go up to $110 because you're going to win, or you're going to go down to $90 because you're going to lose. And this, the computer's going to do this randomly. It's going to give a 49.29% chance of winning each time. And let's see. Oh, the first time you played craps, you lost, right? So you went down to $90. And then you play again. So you might win or lose. Oh, you lost twice in a row, I'm sorry to say. And let me get that running. Let's see. Oh, you lost three times in a row. This may be the worst run ever. Okay, there you go. You're up to 80. And then we say, well, what happens in the long run? And in particular, let's say, what's the chance that we will get up to $200, so we'll have twice as much money as we started with? What's the chance that will happen first before we lose all our money and go to zero? So this is called the gambler's rune problem, as some of you will know. And it's not so trivial to solve for this mathematically, but it's not so hard either. But it's not trivial because we don't know how many steps it's going to take. We don't know how long it's going to go. We say, you know, let's say you're up to $110 now, now you're up to $120. So, you know, you might do well. You might have $130. You think maybe we're going to get up to $200, or maybe not. Maybe we're going to lose. Well, let's speed up a little faster because I don't want to spend the entire 45 minutes on this. But so you see you're making these bets, and you can say while you're doing it, what's the probability if you start at 100 that you're going to get up to 200? And, of course, you should probably already be thinking, well, the reason that casinos make money is because in the long run, you're going to lose more often than you're going to win. But let's see if we can be a little more precise about that. So we can see this is taking a while. It shows the number of bets up there. We're up to 45 bets already. And, in fact, we're right back at $100 where we started from. Let's go a little faster. So here we are making tons and tons of bets. We're up to, what, 70 bets, up to 80 bets. Everything pretty well, up to 140, 160, back down to 120. See, it's still taking a while, right? And there's actually no limit to how long it might take until you either win or lose. Oh, there you go. You finally won. So congratulations. You all went to the casino. You all started with $100, and you went up to $200, right? Then you say, well, gee, if we can do that, then maybe casinos aren't always going to make money, right? Let me try doing another simulation. And this time, let's start with $1,000. And you're still just going to bet $10 each time. So you're just going to go up or down $10. And let's say, again, what's the probability you'll get up to $2,000 before you lose all your money? So let me start this going, and now, of course, it's going to take a really long time because we're just betting tiny $10 each time, so what are we, about 1,000, maybe down to 950, we're going around. So I'm going to do this faster again, and let's speed it up. Now it's not even showing the graphics, and it's still taking a long time. We're now up to 150 bets, 180 bets, 200 bets. Well, maybe it's taking a little too long, so I'm going to go even faster. We're now up to 2,000 bets, 3,000 bets. Okay, after 3,428 bets, you actually lost your money, right? So betting $10 each time, starting with $1,000, in this case, you lost all your money. And we can start saying, well, what are the long-run probabilities? So let me start by thinking about that. So we say, well, what happens in the long run when you're playing craps? Well, so we can think this. We'll say, what's the probability that you're going to double your fortune, the amount of money you have, if you continue to bet $10 at craps? So if you start with $100, that's the first simulation we did, you actually have a pretty good chance. You have about a 43% chance of actually doubling your money. So if you go to the casino with $100 and you keep betting $10, you're not doing so badly for yourself. Yes, you'll lose more than you win, but it's not so far from being fair. Well, if you start with $1,000, like the one we just did, you have about one chance in 18, or about a 5.5% chance. So in other words, as you've got farther and farther to go, it's less and less likely that you're going to beat the house, less and less likely that you're actually going to double your fortune before you lose all your money. Well, what if you have more? What if you start with, say, $10,000? You have about one chance in a 1 followed by 16 zeros, right? One chance in 10 million billion. So the point being, of course, that as you bet more and more, this law of large numbers, as we'll call it, takes over. They'll put that as law of large numbers. You can think of it as sort of being order from chaos, or saying that even though any given bet, you might win, you might lose, and so on, over the long run, the fact that the probabilities are a little bit against you, that's going to take over. And so we can be a little more precise about that, and I want to think of it as a way to lead into MCMC. So what's this law of large numbers? Well, you know, one way to say it is for gambling, that even though the casino just has that tiny, tiny little advantage, you know, you've got a 49.29% chance of winning at craps, that's still enough that the casino over the long run, with, you know, thousands and thousands of customers making hundreds and hundreds of bets, the casino is for sure going to make money. And that's why, you know, when a new casino comes up, people might argue over whether it's a good idea or a bad idea to have a casino, but nobody ever says, gee, what if the casino doesn't make money, right? They always make money, even though any given bet's random, any given customer might make money or not, but over the long run, with lots and lots of bets, it's guaranteed. And a little bit more precise, well, so we can say averages converge to expected values, or to be just a little bit more mathematical, we can say if you have some random variables xi, think of it as like the amount you win or lose on the ice bet, then we can say, well, if you look at this average, it's supposed to be the average amount that you've won or lost after doing n bets, that converges to the true expected value. So in the case of playing craps or any game at the casino, the true expected value for, on average, how much you'll win or lose is slightly a negative, of course, because you have a slightly bigger chance of losing than winning. So it means this expected value is just a little bit negative. It's actually something like minus 14 cents out of every $10 if you're playing craps. But then on the other hand, that means the average amount that you win or lose will be about minus 14 cents. So it means the total amount you win or lose will be about minus 14 cents multiplied by the number of bets that you've made. So if you make lots and lots of bets, you're probably down a lot. If you've made a million bets, you're probably down about $140,000, right? So anyway, it's a way to think about the law of large numbers. And this law of large numbers, certainly applies when you go to the casino, but if you take a bit of a broader view, I like to think of it as something that applies sort of all over life. So certainly any kind of gambling, but other things too, like for example, investing. If you say, well, what's the difference between a good investor and a bad investor? Does that mean the good investor always picks the stocks that always go up the most? Well, no, right? That's not what good investors do. What good investors do is, on average, they tend to pick stocks that go up more than, on average, the other investors pick. So there's sort of a law of large numbers there that over time, the best investors will make the most money, but it doesn't mean they'll make the most money every day. Similarly, if you're, for example, playing a game, well, if one team is better than another team, doesn't mean they're going to win every time, right? But it means if they play over and over again, over the long run, the better team is going to win more. And that's why things like the Stanley Cup playoffs aren't just one game, right? They have a few games in there to try to get as close as they can to the true better team. Some people think there actually should be more games than there are in the playoffs, but I guess the players get tired after a while, right? But the more games you can play, the more accurately you'd be saying which is the better team, not just which team happened to win on a given day. In a different perspective, if you think of a poll or a survey, at the time of an election or something, well, the law of large numbers is at work there too, of course, right? Because if you ask just a few people which way they're going to vote, you don't get a very accurate sense of what the population is going to do. But the more and more people you ask, the closer your estimate gets to the true fraction of people who are planning to vote a given way. And, you know, all the margins of error for polls and all those things they quote are all just making that more quantitative. And the more people you ask, the smaller the margin of error, the more accurate you are. So it comes up in other ways, too. I mean, some people say, well, someone is a lucky person, right? And now that I did write this book for the general public, I was doing a lot of talks with the general public and media and so on, people say, well, what about luck? You know, what about people who are just lucky, right? Well, you know, the way I would say it is that, of course, anyone could be more fortunate or less fortunate on a given day, but over the long run, that luck is going to approximately cancel out, or at least it's not very likely that one person will always be lucky. And you can think of that either that if someone always is successful, maybe it's not just luck, maybe there's something that they're doing right. Or you can think just because someone's gotten lucky a few times, that actually doesn't mean they're going to get lucky next time, too. So, even applies to traffic lights, and I must admit, when I drive around the city of Toronto, I'm convinced that there's a conspiracy on. Conspiracy that traffic lights always turn red just when I get up to them, right? And my wife has to set me straight and says, look, haven't you read your own book? Don't you remember that by the law of large numbers, you're going to get about as many red lights as green lights? But, of course, we only notice the red lights. But anyway, so we have this law of large numbers, this idea that over time, things tend to average out. And then we say, well, okay, let's get into Markov chain Monte Carlo, which is the area that I'm interested in. And so what's the idea of Markov chain Monte Carlo? Well, first of all, it's supposed to be a method for doing computations when things are very complicated. So like those examples we gave at the beginning with, you know, the medical study or the physical system or the high-dimensional integral, we think, you know, there's lots and lots of variables and it's hard to sort everything out. And Markov chain Monte Carlo, or MCMC, is a way to try to work that out. Now, I know some of you will know something about MCMC, but let's assume that you don't. And let me make an analogy. So imagine if you were climbing in a beautiful mountain range and someone said, say, I wonder what the average altitude in this mountain range is. And you look around, right, and you say, well, there's some big peaks over there, and there's some valleys over there, and there's things we don't know about, and so on. Well, it might be kind of hard. And, of course, what you would do if you could is you'd hire an army of research students, right, and they'd go every meter away, and they'd use their barometers or whatever, and they'd get the altitude every meter in a big grid, and they'd average that all out. But if it's a big mountain range, and, you know, your research grant isn't that big, right, then maybe you're not going to be able to do that. So the question is, how could you get an approximation for something like the average height of a mountain range? Well, here's one thing you could do. So if systematic sampling is too time-consuming, then you could imagine exploring randomly, right? So you can imagine saying, look, I've got my little barometer that will tell me the altitude of wherever I am. And you can say, here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to start walking around randomly. I'll walk a few steps this way and a few steps that way and climb up and climb down and so on. And all the while, I'll be averaging out the altitudes of the places that I'm at. And you might imagine that if you wander around for a really long time and you average out the values, then it might converge to the true answer. And that's what Markov chain Monte Carlo is in a nutshell. So it's this idea that you wander around, maybe not a mountain range, but some state space of all these big complicated variables and so on, wander around averaging things up as you go, and you hope that in the long run, this average will approximately converge to the answer that you're interested in. So when I say that, I mean, it might sound like kind of an obscure thing to think about. You know, how often do people really, you know, wander around, either, of course, in real life or on a computer is where we usually do the real wandering. But how often would people use this, you know, wandering around algorithm to try to average out things? Well, it actually does have lots and lots of applications, and the way to prove to an audience that the subject's important is to do a search on the internet and see how many hits you get, right? So if you do a search for markup chain Monte Carlo in quotation marks, you'll get over 750,000 hits, which, you know, is one way, and of course there's also other words for it and other phrases that mean pretty much the same thing. So what it means is that lots and lots of people out there are thinking about and writing papers and posting to web pages things about markup chain Monte Carlo, so it's maybe worth thinking about it a bit more. So let me get into a little more of the details of markup chain Monte Carlo, and then we'll see some examples of it. So in markup chain Monte Carlo, we think we have what we'll call a target distribution pi. I wrote that in blue here on purpose because it'll be blue when we do the animation. And you think of that, that's something like, for example, the heights of those mountains you were trying to sample. Or maybe more so, it's the probabilities associated with all the random variables from that statistical study of the medical study and so on. But anyway, it's some probability distribution that we would like to understand, we would like to sample from. And here's how one simple version of markup chain Monte Carlo works. So here's a little more detail. So remember, it's an algorithm that wanders around. So we'll think of xn as being the position that our wandering is at some time n. And then we want to give a rule for where are we going to wander at time n plus 1. And here's the rule. The rule is that starting from this position xn, we propose, and that might be hard to read because it's in yellow, because it's going to be yellow in the animation, but we propose a new state yn plus 1. So think of if you're wandering around a mountain range, what we'll say now is instead of just always going wherever you feel like going, you consider where to go. You say, maybe I'm going to step over there. So that's my yn plus 1. And then I either accept it or not. I either say, yeah, I'm going to go to yn plus 1, or I say, no, I'm going to stay here at xn minus 1. And we either accept it, that's going to be green, or reject it, that's going to be red, with a certain probability, alpha, of accepting. And alpha is just this funny little formula, which is the minimum of 1 and the ratio of the target probability at the state we're thinking of going to compared to the state we're at. And in a second, I'll do an animation. But anyway, so the plan is that over time, with this random wandering, the probabilities should converge to the target probability. So let's see if we can see that in action, hopefully. Yeah, here we go. So here's another simple graphical simulation. In this case, these are the blue bars, which remember they're the targets, so they're like the heights of the mountains, or they're the probabilities associated with the medical study or with the physical system and so on. There are certain probabilities that we would like to converge to. This black dot, now it's no longer representing the amount of money we have when we're gambling. Now it's representing the wandering around on the mountain range, or the markup chain, which is going to randomly move around on just the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, so it's a simple illustration, and it's going to randomly move around, but each time it's going to propose either to move to the right or the left by 1, and then, as I said, it's going to either accept or reject that. So the first time it's going to propose, it's going to say, I don't know if you can see these white dots, but it's going to decide to either propose to a white dot to the right or to the left, and it's randomly going to choose, okay, it chose to go to the right, and now it's got to decide whether or not to accept this move. And remember, the rule is it compares the blue bar height at the new place to the old place. In this case, the new blue bar is higher, so it's always going to accept it. So this is going to turn green, and it's going to accept it, so the black bar moves over, and it tries again. This time it's going to propose either to 5 or to 7. In fact, it proposed to 5. Now it has to make a decision. It has to say either I'm going to accept moving to 5, or I'm going to stay at 6, and I'll accept with probability the ratio of this height here over this height here. So it's about an 80% chance it's going to accept. And, oh, it rejected. Isn't that exciting? We got a rejection early on. So this turned red. That means it's not going to go to 5. It's going to stay at 6. And then it keeps going. Let me get that running. So it's going to propose again to go to 5. It rejected again. That's actually bad luck. Now it's going to go to 7. It'll always reject there because that's off the edge of the blue bars. So it's going to reject that. Hopefully at some point it will come back. While it's, let's see, maybe this time, yeah, this time it accepted and it went to 5. While it's doing that, let me add one more ingredient to the simulation. These are the black bars, and they represent what we call the empirical distribution, and they just represent what fraction of the time this black dot, or this wanderer, has spent so far at each of these 6 points. So far it's spent a lot of time at 6, so it's kind of stuck there for a bit, and it hasn't spent any time at 1, and it's spent just a little bit of time here. And as it moves on, let me make it go a little faster, it's still doing these rules of proposing and either accepting or rejecting. It's going to move around, and so now it's back at 5 and 4 and so on. You might say, well, you know, what's the point of all this random moving around back and forth? Well, the point is, the big excitement here that makes MCMC work is that over time, the black bars are going to converge in height to the blue bars. So that is to say, over time, the fraction of time that it spends at each of these points will converge to the heights of these blue bars. And that's why this algorithm, called the Metropolis algorithm, it's one version of MCMC, that's why it was defined exactly the way it was with those acceptance probabilities, is because those are just the right acceptance probabilities to mean that on average, that over time, it's going to approximately converge, well, it will converge in the limit, to the blue bars. So how does this help us? Well, what this means is if we could run the black dot on a computer, and that was easy to do, even though the blue bars were hard to figure out and hard to understand, then that would be good, because the black bars, the black dots and then the black bars are things that are easy to compute, and the blue bars are the things that we're interested in. So if we think of the mountain range one more time, we'd be saying it's easy as we wander around to keep track of where we've been and keep track of the heights that we've come to, but it's hard to just understand this whole mountain range all at once. So the wandering, the black stuff, converges to the blue stuff. And in fact, it's converging. Let me speed up a little more. It's already, we actually got quite lucky because it converged pretty well after just 80 or 90 steps. And of course, over time, this will oscillate around a little bit, but we know, it's easy to see from Markov-Chain theory, that in the limit, these black bars will be the same height as the blue bars. And it means if we try to understand the big complicated model that we're in the middle of, if we understand that using the black dot, using the Markov chain, then we'll get a very good approximation to the truth that we would have gotten from the blue bars. Okay, so let me move on. Are there any questions specifically about this? Because I'm going to move on to some other examples at the back there. Well, you mean in this example or in the complicated ones? It depends on the context. So, I mean, it's true that there's a bit of subtlety here in the sense that if we had no idea what the blue bars were, then of course we couldn't define the algorithm and we couldn't define the ratio. So what we need in order to run this algorithm is we need to be able to say for any two points, we need to compute the ratio of the blue bar at one divided by the blue bar at the other. And it turns out in the example, I'll try to say a little more about that as we go, that oftentimes, it's not hard to do that because we have a functional form for the height of the blue bar at any one point. But then you might say, well, if we can do that, then why do we need these Markov chains? Why can't we just understand the blue bars? And the answer is that it's one thing to be able to compute the ratio of the blue bars at two points, and it's another to, for example, be able to integrate over all the blue bars to get the average height, that kind of thing. So yeah, it's a good question in a way. I mean, to run the Markov chains, we need to know a little bit about the blue bars, but we don't need to know that much, or at least from a computational point of view, we need to know things which are usually easy to compute, and we don't need to know things which are usually hard to compute. So. Okay, another question? Yeah.
How do you set a terminal condition?
Set a what? Sorry. You mean the terminating condition? When should it? Right. Yeah. When should it end? I think the question is, you know, we run the Markov chain for a while. When does it end? That's actually a very subtle question. I'll come back to that. The simple answer is that it's. To a large extent, it's sort of an unsolved problem, and people use hacks to try to figure out when they think they've run enough. But yeah, it's quite close to my own research area, so I'm glad you think it's as important as I do. We're getting a lot of questions, but okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think it's very important how you choose the proportional.
Right.
Right,
so I will say a little more about that too. So the question, if you couldn't hear, is how do we choose the proposal? So in this case, in other words, we're always proposing for this black dot to either move one step to the right or one step to the left with probability 50-50, and that's called the proposal distribution. And in general, there could be all kinds of different proposal distributions, and some of them might converge faster and some of them might converge slower. I'll come back to that because I will say more about it later, but it is a good question. It's something else that there's no complete solution to, but we know some things about it. So I'll come back to that. George, yeah. Right, yeah, that's correct. So what this actually is it's converging to sort of the probability distribution governed by the blue bars. And then we can, once we have that, we can use that then to estimate averages of different functionals or probabilities. So for example, maybe you just care about the probability of the 0.6 and then you'd estimate that. Or maybe you care about, you know, the average number, say the weighted average of 1 to 6 weighted by the blue bars. So what you care about would depend on the application too, but once we can sample, then we can get all those things, or at least approximately. So, okay, one more question, then I'll move on.
Suppose you have no blue bar, as say 3, which means that there are nothing between bars, and
Yeah, so that's right. It's actually related to the earlier question about the proposal distribution. So we need the markup chain to be what's called irreducible, and what you're saying is a case where it would not be irreducible because there'd be a hole here that we couldn't jump over. In fact, an example that I'll get to if I have time is where that's almost the case. But yeah, so in a case like that, you have to make sure to choose your markup chain or choose your proposals in such a way that you are irreducible. And of course, in a simple example, it's easy to see, but in a big complicated example, it might be hard to even tell if you're reducible. A lot of the time, the blue bars will be a positive everywhere, so being actually irreducible isn't a problem, but they might be almost zero, so it might be almost impossible. So anyway, there's a lot of good questions, and you see how complicated and difficult markup chain Monte Carlo can be. But anyway, let me move on a bit, because that was just getting to the sort of definition. So now we see how markup chain Monte Carlo works. And let me say just a quick word about why this works. So I know I don't want to put too many formulas on the screen on a Saturday afternoon, right? But let's just say one here. So this is something, if you've ever studied markup chains, then this formula should look very familiar to you. And this is saying, so if the P's are the probabilities of, say, if you're at the state X, what's the probability you end up at the state Y? So the jump probabilities. And if pi are the blue bars, right? So they're the probabilities associated with the blue bars. Then this simple equation says that pi, this simple equation says that pi is a stationary distribution. And so what does that mean? That means that if you happen to start running the Markov chain with the probabilities given by the blue bars, and then you ran it for one step, then it would still have the probabilities given by the blue bars. Or if you want to think in terms of operators, you can say that pi is, you know, an eigenvector with eigenvalue 1 of the operator p, which gives the Markov chain. Or if you know, it's something that leaves this particular collection of probabilities invariant. And then it's not hard to say, if it's irreducible, related to that previous question, that those black bars will converge to those blue bars. And so in other words, it all sort of comes down to checking this sort of equation. And I'll put this a quick sentence. Oops, that was a little too quick. But quick word about why this equation does hold. So if you want to check this equation, well, actually what you can check is that pi of x times p of xy is equal to pi of y times p of yx. And that's called being reversible with respect to the uniform distribution, or sort of this symmetric property. And that's good enough to easily check that this equation holds. And this equation equals this one. It's just a very simple computation, and it comes down to that definition of that acceptance probability. So Saturday afternoon, I won't go through this too much, but it's a very simple argument to say that that acceptance probability, that minimum of 1 and the ratio of the blue bars, was exactly what we needed to make it work out that pi would be a stationary distribution. So somehow, you know, it's just we made those acceptance probabilities right to make sure that the black bars do converge to the blue bars. And again, it's called the Metropolis algorithm. It's just one of many ways to run a MCMC algorithm just to make sure it works out right. And I mean, the funny thing is that somehow this is the easy part. That is, it's somehow, for some reason, it's very easy to define markup chains which asymptotically converge to the right distribution. That's almost the easy part of MCMC. But anyway, a couple of people copy this. If you want, I have it on a paper afterwards. But for now, I think I'm going to spare you from any more equations. Right? But anyway, let me go back to a few of the examples. So let me say, well, suppose you wanted to, for example, compute a high-dimensional integral. So suppose you wanted to compute, say, I, and I is, you know, the integral of h times f with respect to, say, the Lebesgue measure or even some other measure. And, you know, you think it's high-dimensional, and say f is, let's say, a probability density, so something that could define probabilities. So you can think of this as wanting to compute an expected value of a functional h with respect to the probabilities given by this f. So, well, one thing you could do, and it's certainly not the only way at all that one can compute hard integrals, but one thing you could do is you could run an MCMC algorithm, right? One of these updating random things. Run it in such a way that it will have a stationary distribution. The blue bars, as it were, will be the distribution given by this density function f. That is to say, run something, you know, you're wandering around, but make sure your wanderings are such that the blue bars, the thing that you'll converge to, will be actually according to that density f here. And if you can do that, well, then you can average things up. So you can do something like take for, so suppose b is large and m is large, then roughly speaking, these xi's have the distribution pi, because we know after a long time the black bars are going to converge to the blue bars. So then we say, well, you could estimate this integral I by just averaging, so that's supposed to be a 1 over m, didn't show up too well, but it's a 1 over m times the sum of m different copies of h of xi. So that is a way of estimating the expected value of h with respect to the distribution given by f, which is exactly what this integral is. So So in other words, to summarize, you say, you know, let's run a Markov chain, which over time will converge to these probabilities given by F, and then we average up H over those probabilities. That's the way to estimate this integral. So, and again, the fact that it will converge for large M is our old law of large numbers. It's our old thing like with the gambling. Just like we knew the casinos were going to make money, we know that if you wander around long enough, then you'll get a good estimate of the integral. So again, you can compute high-dimensional integrals, in principle at least, by running a Markov chain and just averaging up the values over the Markov chain. So anyway, so at least in principle and sometimes in practice, we can use MCMC to compute complicated high-dimensional integrals. What about the other examples? Well, one example is, remember, the physics system with the different particles. And so you can, you know, usually the way this is modeled is something like that there's energy associated with different configurations of the particles. And so maybe something like, say, some function h of, let's say, the distance. It might not depend only on the distance, but maybe it depends on, say, the distance between two particles. So the overall energy of the system might be some sum of h of the distance between pairs of particles summed over all the pairs. Anyway, well, whatever it is, some rule for, let's say, the energy of a system based on certain configurations and maybe involving a thousand and thousands of different particles. So then you say, well, you know, according to statistical physics, the probability of a configuration is supposed to be proportional to the exponential of minus the energy divided by the absolute temperature, right? Something like that. So anyway, so the point is there should be some rule in principle for saying, given a certain configuration, what is the probability of this configuration, or at least what is it proportional to? So then you say, and this maybe I'll come back again to a question before about, you know, how do we know the blue bars or what do we know about them? Well, this would be a case where for a particular fixed configuration of particles, we can, you know, just add this stuff up and maybe we can compute the energy. But that's quite different from saying we can understand on average what's going to happen to the particles or what's the probability they're going to be within a certain distance of each other and so on. So that's why we'd like to be able to sample from it. And again, in principle, we could run a Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm, something like the applet example, but a little more complicated because now it's a Markov chain where the state space is all the possible configurations of all these different particles. But it would be some sort of a Markov chain that involves randomly, say, proposing to move certain particles and then accepting or rejecting that according to the ratio of the energies involved. So somehow we could run a Markov chain which has the stationary probabilities, or the blue bars, proportional to this energy function that we believe the physical system is telling us. And again, in principle, you can run it even if you have thousands of particles because we don't need to integrate over it. We don't need to sum over it all. We just need to be able to compute the ratio of the energy of one configuration compared to the energy of some other configuration to decide whether to accept or reject a move. And so even with thousands of particles, you can do that. And then you can do things like estimate, say, the average distance between the particles or you know, the probability that the particles are all on one half of the room or whatever it is that you're interested in. You can estimate all those things in principle. And of course, I know there's a lot of specific details depending on the exact configurations you're doing. But the point is people actually do this, and yes, it actually does work. So, okay, let me talk about the medical inference or medical study, which is related to statistical modeling. So let's say, suppose you imagine you have a whole bunch of patients, maybe a capital K patients, and that number might be, you know, fairly big, maybe hundreds. And let's say for each patient, maybe you have a capital J different observations on them, because, you know, with medical testing, you know, maybe you measure their blood pressure every month or, you know, things like that. So you have a whole bunch of different, you know, patients, and then for each patient you have a whole bunch of different observations, and then you want to measure something like the overall effect of treatment or something like that. Well, you'd build some sort of a statistical model, and the actual statistical modeling would depend on the details, but here's the kind of thing that people tend to do. So you might have a statistical model something like saying, well, maybe there's some overall effect of the treatment, let's call that mu, and then there's theta 1, theta 2, up to theta k, which is for each patient, there's what the effect of that drug or treatment is on the ice patient, so there's k of those, and you might say, well, we assume that these are all, you know, somewhat related to the overall effectiveness of the treatment, but there's some uncertainty too. So maybe, for example, each of these has, a normal distribution centered at mu, this unknown overall treatment, with some variance, and maybe the variance is unknown too, or even the distribution's unknown. But you have some sense that, well, there's some overall treatment, there's some effect of the treatment on each patient, and there's some relation between them, some sort of probabilities. And then you have your actual observations, so maybe the whys here are the things that you actually get to observe, because you don't even know what the effect was on the patient. You just know according to the test that you got back from the lab what seems to be going on. So maybe you've got, you know, Y11, Y12, up to Y1j for the first station, and similarly for all the other ones. And maybe those are, again, things which maybe they're pretty close to the true value for that patient, but with some uncertainty. So you build up some sort of a statistical model, and again, there's all kinds of different models that people use depending on the circumstances. But then what? Well, then you'd say you would like to, well, let me actually stop that for a second. Let's say you'd like to be able to understand these things. You'd like to say, well, given, you know, this model of all these things, and given the observations that we actually have, what can we say about the overall effect of the treatment? What can we say about the probability that the treatment's going to kill someone, and so on? So again, leaving out a lot of details, you could run an MCMC algorithm. And so you might run it, and again, pi here might be, well, if you're, for example, doing a Bayesian inference approach, and I won't get into all that right now, but one thing you might say is it will assign probabilities in principle to all the different things that could happen, and then we end up with some big probability distribution called the posterior distribution, and I'll write it pi again, and that would correspond to, according to this statistical model and according to the observations we made, what are all the probabilities for all the different things that could happen. Big complicated model, lots of patients and so on, but again, in principle, we can run an MCMC algorithm, converge hopefully to these pi's, and then do things like estimate the average effect of the treatment and things like that, things that were unknown, but that can be estimated. And again, people do it all the time in, you know, medical statistics, biostatistics and so on. People are running MCMC just like crazy to solve these things. So, okay, so let me make a few more general points about MCMC, and then if I have a little time at the end, I want to talk about one more thing too. But what can we say about MCMC? Well, the first thing I've kind of already said this is that, you know, it converges over the long run, right? So it's kind of like the gambling, and it's saying that, yeah, you can't run it for a little while. You have to run it for a long time. How long? I'll come back to you if I can. But you have to run it for a long time, and in the long run, it approximately converges to what you want. It's got some MCMC researcher once put this as saying, actually, MCMC is the worst method, but you have to use it because often there's no other method that works. So if you can do something more direct, then you know, it's better to do it. If you can compute things analytically using your tricks from calculus, it's better. If you can do a simple numerical integration, it's better. But often you can't. Things are too high-dimensional, too complicated. You can't do those things, so you have to use it. I guess it's a bit like when Winston Churchill said that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other ones, right? So sort of the same with MCMC. It's the worst one except maybe it's the only one that works. So, and as I say, it's actually used a tremendous amount, so it is often the only one that works, or at least the only one that works as easily, let's say. So a quick little bit of history is that these algorithms are sort of interesting, have been with us for over half a century now. So there's a famous paper in 1953 that first presented what really was the Metropolis algorithm, kind of like that applet that I ran. And in some sense, the algorithms haven't changed that much since then. I mean, there's a lot of different tweaks and variations that we use, but in essence, it's really the same idea they had back in 1953. And part of what I find so remarkable about that is when you stop and think what the computers were like back in 1953, right? And it was incredibly slow to get one iteration of these things, and now everyone at their desktop can just run these things like crazy. And the reason they've only become really hot and popular in about the last 15 years or so is because finally computers were fast enough that every researcher could afford to buy a fast one and put it on their desk. So anyway, it's just a quick historical note. Dan, this is, I think, somebody asking about, you know, how do I think over there, how do we know when to stop this thing, right? So this issue, you run a Markov chain, and over time, these, you know, black bars should converge to the blue bars, and over time, we should get a good estimate. How do we know how long to run it? Well, what people typically do in practice, and that's why I say this is largely an open question, is use what are called convergence diagnostics. And roughly speaking, that means you put on your statistical hat, and you say, let's just look at the output. So say those black bars, let's say the black dots. Let's look what's happening with the black dots. And you know, the black dot's going to keep moving around randomly, but if after a while it seems to keep on moving around randomly in the same kind of way, then that means we've approached a stationary distribution. So you imagine, you know, if you start off somewhere far away and at first it's just moving over towards the middle, well, you say, okay, we haven't converged yet. But once you're in the middle and you seem to be moving around, you think, well, maybe we've converged. But maybe we haven't, right? Because maybe if we started from somewhere else, we might have gone somewhere else. So people will run, you know, multiple versions of the Markov chain starting from different places and see if they get the same answer. And there's a lot of work that's gone into that. In my opinion, it's all kind of problematic because, you know, in practice it usually works, but it doesn't provide any kind of a guarantee. And if you just happen to miss out on part of the space, you know, maybe you didn't realize that the blue bars got big over there too, because after all, it's a high-dimensional, complicated thing. You might not be able to understand it. Then you might actually miss out. So it's actually quite a problem. It so happens that my own research, a lot of my research has been related to considering the same problem from a more mathematical point of view. And so ideally what we'd like to do is have mathematical theorems which will prove something, like say, look at, you know, what's the probability that if you run the Markov chain for B steps, let's say, what's the probability you'll be in some subset compared to what you would get with the blue bars? And if we could prove this is small, say less than 1% or less than some small number, then we say, okay, I can prove that if you run this for B steps, then yeah, we're actually getting a pretty accurate answer. And, you know, as I say, a lot of my research has been doing that for some models, including the one that I showed for the that medical thing. But it's pretty messy and complicated, and in particular, people use MCMC for really high-dimensional complicated problems, and of course, that's when it's the hardest for a mathematician to actually be able to bound everything. So it's something I'm quite interested in. I was originally thinking of giving this talk more about that, but then I thought I'll keep it less technical. If anyone does want more details of the mathematics that goes into proving things, I have just a 2-page double-sided paper here that anyone's welcome to take a copy of, which is sort of a summary of some of the things that I and others have thought about with that. So it's a pretty interesting topic, and mathematically speaking, I think it's exciting because it has the potential to have applications in lots of other fields, but it's also quite interesting from a mathematical point of view, I think. But on the other hand, you know, it's hard to do it in the really complicated situation. So this is sort of an ongoing debate or an ongoing battle of how to understand the convergence or, let's say, the time until we stop and so on. So let me, in the last few minutes, talk about a related question. This is related. Someone asked about how do we choose the proposal distribution. So this is actually quite related to that. So this is the issue of, you know, this MCMC. It's this really clever idea where we do this random updating and we converge to the black bars converge to the blue bars and so on. But in some sense, we have an embarrassment of riches. There's lots of different choices that we could make for what Markov chain to use. Because, as I said, it's so easy to define these Markov chains which have the right stationary distribution. And so in particular, if we go back to that example that we had at the beginning, which I'll go back to in a minute, remember we said in that case we propose either to move to the left by one step or to the right by one step. Well, there's lots of other things you could do. And one is you could say, well, I'm going to propose to move to the left by one or two steps, or to the right by one or two steps, or one or two or three steps and so on. So let me run that again. I guess I'm going to go back to the same applet we had before. So we'll stop that. Let me tell you what, I'm going to reset it. And if I'm lucky, this is going to work. Yeah, so let's do it. Let's run it again, where this time it's going to propose, instead of just going to the left one or to the right one, it's going to go, and I don't know if you can see the white dots, it's going to go to the left either 3 or 2 or 1, or to the right either 1 or 2 or 3. So it's going to propose something more bold, maybe. And, oh, in fact, it just proposed to move by 1, so you won't see any difference this time. And then it's going to accept that. Let's propose again. Okay, this time it proposed to go by 2. So it's the same rule as before. It's going to decide whether or not to accept this probability based on the ratio of the height of this guy over the height of this guy. So it's about, what, maybe a 50% or a little more chance to accept it. In fact, it did accept it. And it's going to go on, and I'll let it run. But now it's just a little different, right? It's proposing either 1, 2, or 3 steps instead of just one. Let me go a little faster since time is short. And so then you say, well, this is again a valid Markov chain Monte Carlo algorithm. It again should converge. The black bars should converge to the blue bars. And then you can say, well, you know, how quickly will it converge? And let me run it faster. So it's running along, and then you say, well, we've already ran for, let's say, for 35 steps. Well, we're not really that close. 50 steps, we're not that close. But hopefully over time we'll get closer. The black bars, well, actually we're sure that eventually the black bars will converge to the blue bars. But then you say, well, which is a smarter version? Is it smarter to do the version which just proposes to go plus or minus 1 each time, or the version that proposes to go plus or minus 1, 2, or 3 each time? Well, if you had to eyeball this, you'd probably decide that the 1, 2, or 3 version is actually smarter, right? Because somehow it doesn't get stuck in the same place for longer. It jumps around more. It's got more randomness to it. So if you think of it that way, you might say, well, that's the key to making these Markov chains work. We need to propose things which are really far apart. But on the other hand, you don't want to take that to extremes, right? So let's do a more extreme example. Let me stop that. And let's say we propose, tell you what, I'm going to go straight to proposing 50. So it's going to propose to subtract either 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 all the way up to minus 50, or add 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 up to plus 50. And let's see how that works. So I'm going to propose it. So it's proposing. And in fact, it proposed something right off the edge of the screen, right? We didn't even see it. So, again, I don't think you can see the white dots too well, but it's proposing each time. And it's actually, in fact, let me reset the counter. So we'll see. We started at 4. Oh, it proposed something there, but it rejected it because it was still off the edge, so it stayed at 4. Proposed something right off the edge of the screen, so it stayed at 4 again. And let me do this faster. Eventually, it will propose something else. Eventually, it proposed something else that it accepted. But now it stayed at 6 for a really long time. And eventually, it should propose something else. Oh, it throws that, but I'm still, okay, well, we actually went back to 4. That's pretty bad luck, right? So now we've only been at 4 and 6, even though we've gone for 75 iterations. Oh, now we finally made it to 5. But we can see this isn't so hot either, right? So that is, if we propose plus or minus 1, that's not so hot because, you know, it takes a long time to get everywhere. If we propose plus or minus 1 up to 50, that's even worse, right? It's going to take so long until it proposes something that it can actually accept. And we can see that the black bars are really not getting very close to the blue bars at all because it's hardly ever jumping. So let me, I know I'm almost out of time, but let me say a few more things about that. So in this example, so I already sort of said, if gamma is too small, that's not so good. If gamma is too big, that's not so good. And what we really want, and I call this the Goldilocks principle, right? We want something that's just right. We want to propose something that's not, you know, up to 50, that's too big in this case, but not only 1, that's too small. And so in this example, probably about gamma equal to 4 is about the best. So if you do about plus or minus 1, 2, 3, or 4, then you're doing pretty well. But then you say, okay, in this example, we could just look at it and see, what about in a big, hard, complicated example? And one thing you could try to do is get the computer to try to help you figure that out. And this is something I've been working on the last couple of years, and so we call it adaptive MCMC. And the idea is, you know, the state space is so big and complicated that not only can we not figure everything out directly, so we need a markup chain, but we can't even figure out which are the smart markup chains and which are the stupid markup chains. And so maybe the computer can help us. And let's see, I'm going to, all right, well, let me quickly do this example, and then I'll be done. So this example, well, you could say, you know, this value of gamma, we'd like to know what's a smart value. Well, maybe the computer can help us. And so we could have a version which says something like, when a proposal is accepted, well, that means maybe we're not being ambitious enough. Gamma is just maybe 1 or 2. So maybe we can increase gamma by 1. And when a proposal is rejected, then maybe we have to decrease gamma, because after all, we're proposing things really far away, like 50, and that's just too big, right? So intuitively, we could say if we accept, maybe we can make gamma a little bigger. If we reject, we can make it a little smaller. And we can say, how does that work? So let me, maybe I'll finish with running one last applet, and this one, tell you what, let me bring that down a bit. Okay, so let's try running this one, where it's going to work, sorry, I'm going to put on adaption here. So what's it going to do? The first time it's proposing, I don't know how well we can see the white dots again, but it's proposing plus or minus 2, and it moved over there. Now it's going to accept that, because in this case these blue bars are the same. So it accepted that, it moves over here. Now it says, well, since I accepted, you know, this is easy, maybe I'm not being bold enough, maybe I can increase gamma by 1. So this time it's actually going to propose, I don't know if you can see it, plus or minus 1, 2, or 3. So it's saying, let's be a little more bold, and it proposed that one, so it's going to accept that one. And now it says, oh, this is easy, I can make gamma even bigger. It's going to increase it up to 4. Let me get this running a bit. It's going to say plus or minus 4, and now it's plus or minus 5, but then when it gets too big, then it shrinks it again. So unfortunately, you can't see the white dots too well, but you can also see the gamma values here. And it's adjusting as it goes between big values of gamma, but then if it seems too big, it's making smaller values of gamma. So in principle, the idea here is the computer is going to help us figure it out, right? You know, so I think of this, I say, you know, computers are getting faster and faster and faster, while human speed is staying about the same, right? So the more we can get the computer to help us figure things out, the better. And so in principle, we can do this kind of thing, but it turns out you have to do it very carefully. And in fact, this exact algorithm will actually not, I should put the black bars on, but it will not converge exactly to the right distribution. Because somehow when you start messing with the markup chain, you have to do it very carefully. And then we have some theorems that I guess I won't get into now, but theorems which say when it's okay to have the computer help you modify things and when it's not. And I like it partially because it has at least the potential to be quite useful for practice because, you know, these big complicated models, maybe it's too hard to figure out, but the computer can help us. And also the mathematics is really important because somehow you can't just go off and try whatever you want without any theory or you'll actually converge to the wrong thing and you might not know it. So we need to be able to prove when things do and don't converge. So I think it's an exciting area, but I won't take up more time. But let me just sort of wrap up by saying that you know, I think of MCMC as in some ways being a metaphor for the mathematical sciences as a whole in the sense that they have some connections and applications to a whole bunch of different areas, but they also need a lot of serious mathematics involved too. So, you know, to come back to, I know you're all, you know, thinking of going to graduate school in the mathematical sciences, and I'd, you know, encourage you to do so and to study hard and to keep sort of an open mind about all the different connections that there are to mathematical thinking and to computer thinking and to sciences and so on. And it's really exciting. There's a lot of stuff out there to think about. So anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you very much.